It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now to the powerful animal tranquilizer xylazine that's showing up in street drugs and contributing to a growing number of overdose deaths. The White House calling it an emerging threat. Join in by calling with your questions and concerns, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Marian Mason is an associate professor of emergency medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Marian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So the highly potent and addictive synthetic opioid fentanyl is being mixed with the veterinary sedative xylazine, the federal government sending these strong signals of concern. What are the added risks in this combination of street drugs?
It is a very powerful combination that produces strong sedation. So there's a number of concerns and risks. One is the strong sedation makes people vulnerable to crime and assault. So if they're strongly sedated, they can't fight back or put themselves in a safer situation. Two, xylazine mixed with fentanyl creates a deadly combination. Xylazine is not an opioid, so an overdose with xylazine on board can't be fully reversed by naloxone. So there's no reversal agent that applies to xylazine. And three, and probably the most concerning in the immediate, is that it creates spontaneous wounds on the body of the user. And it's not just at the injection site. These wounds can emerge anywhere. And of course, wounds are a big threat because of infection and sepsis and all the negative things that can happen there.
I wonder if you can't use naloxone in opioid reversal medication, and that's only going to counteract the effects of the opioid in this mixture, what additional help would a victim need to survive?
Right. They would need immediate medical care. But just to clarify, if there is an overdose, you should always try naloxone, because usually people use xylazine in combination with fentanyl. So there may be a way to reverse part of the overdose. But usually people will need to be watched and supported in their respiration if they have xylazine involved in their overdose.
Why would dealers be mixing these two drugs?
There's two kind of reasons that I'm aware of. One is it sort of bulks up the supply. So when fentanyl supplies become shorter or harder to get, people can add adulterants like xylazine to sort of bulk up the supply. The other is people actually are sort of acting like their own pharmacists and trying to get a drug mix they want. So fentanyl has a very deep but short-lived high. And so people are trying to extend that by adding xylazine to extend the fentanyl high.
Marian, how are clinicians treating patients with addictions to xylazine?
This is tricky. So if you mean treating from an overdose or wounds, they're giving wound care and trying to warn people of the dangers of xylazine.
That would be the physical piece of it, but what about the mental health component?
Right. So the actual treatment and recovery from substance abuse is a harder story. So we have medication-assisted treatment for opioid use disorder, buprenorphine or methadone, that can help people overcome the cravings and make it to recovery. But for xylazine, there has to be a period of withdrawal. And the withdrawal is very, very intense. Someone described it to me as having a 2-week constant panic attack where you're unable to sleep. And so getting people through that is an enormous task, and it's hard on people. It's hard on their bodies and their minds and their spirits. Most, if people are being treated for xylazine withdrawal, it is recommended that they're prescribed benzos, which are a calming drug, but the trouble with that is people can use that to overcome the anxiety attack. But if people are still actively using opioids, it is a very dangerous thing.
Oh, it has repercussions there. And we're going to pause with sociologist and substance use researcher Marian Mason, associate professor of emergency medicine at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A sedative designed for animals is now adding to the overdose epidemic across the country. The federal government sounding the alarm over xylazine. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Marian Mason is an associate professor of emergency medicine at Northwestern University. Marianne, last month, a group of lawmakers in Congress introduced a bill that would list xylazine as a Schedule 3 drug on the Controlled Substances Act. Although, you know, veterinarians use xylazine as an animal tranquilizer for medical procedures for decades. How is xylazine's rising popularity as a narcotic affecting veterinarians' access?
Well, thanks for that question. It isn't yet affecting veterinarians' access to xylazine, but should it be scheduled, it will. It will make it a substance that they have to file paperwork around and order in a different way.
Should, do you think, xylazine be on the controlled substances list?
I do. One of the reasons why it needs to be on the list is people who are in possession of it for drug dealing purposes can't be prosecuted because it's currently unscheduled. So adding it to the schedule will allow law enforcement to have a role in this.
Would there be better tracking of xylazine, better data for researchers like you if it were added to the list?
I believe so. I think it would require registration and documentation of usage and amounts acquired and used. So we could end up with a system that helps us identify the sources. And once sources are identified, it's easier to stop them.
You had mentioned how xylazine can create these really hardened black sores on random parts of the body. Do you know how often are drug users aware they are taking drugs with xylazine in them?
You know, that's tricky because we do not have a well-developed drug checking system for illicit drugs. Mm-hmm. We're not sure from moment to moment or place to place what exactly is in the drug supply. So my bet is that people taking these substances don't know what exactly is in them, which is why things like testing strips are extremely important.
Can you talk more about testing strips, where people access the strips, how they are emerging?
Mm-hmm. So they're new on the market. I think they've just been commercially approved in the last 2 months. But testing strips allow people to test a liquid or a powder drug supply to enable determination if xylazine is in their mix. And so it doesn't tell you how much is in there, just whether it's present or not. But it is a tool that people who use drugs can use to determine if xylazine is in their mix and then make an informed decision about whether or not they want to use those drugs.
How available are the strips to the general public now?
Currently they're coming online, so they're not readily available. What I foresee is as production gears up and things are shipped, harm reduction outreach offices will have them to give out to people who use drugs. So harm reduction is usually targeted to places with known drug use. And so they offer tools to help people who are using drugs be safer as they use. So harm reduction teams would probably hand them out, much like they do fentanyl test strips now.
In our last few moments together, do you think will xylazine emerge as a drug of abuse by itself on its own in the future? What is the future like?
At the moment, I think the future is pretty scary in terms of the illicit drug supply. New substances are emerging all the time, and xylazine is one of the most damaging ones I've seen emerge. So I'm actually fearful for the future and hopeful at the same time. We are developing tools to help people with drug abuse issues use more safely, and we're also looking at what causes people to use drugs and trying to address that as well.
Marianne, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, and I'm originally from Wisconsin, so this is a big
Oh.
honor.
Marianne Mason, Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Northwestern University. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to the renewed bipartisan push for legislation that would require consent from patients in order for healthcare providers or med students to do a pelvic exam on someone who is unconscious. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gina Denick Champion is here, Chief Executive Officer of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. Gina, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. Give us a sense of where we stand right now. Are pelvic exams currently being performed on unconscious patients without prior consent?
I'm not so sure if that's still occurring. I think with the legislative bills that have been brought forward in the past, where there's a lot of that re-examination taking place about it. But I do think that it's important that we have some sort of language in the law that talks about policies prohibiting hospitals having policies that prohibit these sorts of examinations without, doing it without the permission, written and verbal permission by the patient.
Can you walk us through a scenario for an unconscious patient when this might perhaps happen?
I just remember a case where the woman was testifying at the public hearing, and how. And this was a couple of years ago, probably, and how she did not find out until after the fact that there were medical students that were learning how to do or increasing their skills on how to do pelvic exams. And there was no permission granted. There was the informed consent was pretty vague, and it left her really traumatized. With that event when she found out that all of this took place without her permission.
There is debate as to whether this constitutes assault. How do you view it?
Well, I think we have to look at it from, a code of ethics. And for nurses, we have that, that we're going to be advocating for the best interest of the patient. And there are so many other ways that students can learn all sorts of procedures. One being we have really high fidelity simulation these days. We also have patients or individuals that are willing to be patients, where you know, a student could practice and also get feedback from that individual. We you know, we know that this is about learning. And when we are we crossing the line when we talk about is this sexual assault in a learning environment? Some people would say yes. Others are saying, you know, we can easily remedy this if we just be very open with and honest with that individual by letting them know, by the way, or will you give us permission to perform, teach our students how to perform a pelvic exam? So it's all about permission.
All about permission. It also makes you wonder whether there are other ethically questionable aspects of the medical school curriculum or the even the advanced practice nursing curriculum that should be discussed in a broader context in society.
Well, in this case, we believe that, again, we have our code and no one should be coerced into, number one, performing an exam where they're not comfortable. Secondly, not having the permission of that individual smacks us right into our code of ethics, and that there are other ways to learn how to do these procedures.
More than 20 states ban pelvic exams without informed consent. PBS doing the accounting. Their legislation here in Wisconsin, introduced in 2021, would have banned these exams here. That legislation failed, as you know, to gain enough traction to pass. What are the concerns with, you know, opponents have raised to this?
You know, that's a really good question. When we're thinking about the rights of the patient, and that's what we should always be in advocating for that patient. I don't know whether it's just, you know, we don't want any mandates, not sure. But I think in cases like this, there is certainly incredible rationale for why it is important to have that permission. And I think we have our, you know, our nurse midwife students. We have, you're right, the advanced practice nurses we have that are also performing pelvic exams. But not having the permission would certainly is not appropriate.
We're talking with Gina Denick-Champion, heads up the Wisconsin Nurses Association. This legislation, bipartisan legislation involving unconscious patients and getting consent for pelvic exams. You can join in with your questions, your concerns at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gina, the practice often done for med students to learn how to perform certain pelvic or prostate exams, how would this legislation affect the way medical students learn? You keep saying that there is other ways, other technology.
Well, there is. We've talked about high fidelity simulation. There's also, you know, what a lot of schools are doing now is they are hiring. They would hire an individual who was willing to be the patient and not only being there as a real person, but being awake and being able to talk and listen to how that individual is talking to them as a provider, but also the procedure itself, you know, what, you know, to let the person know that hurts or just give that other feedback. That's available. And I think the days of not informing individuals that this, you know, that it's vague is also inappropriate.
We've been through the Me Too era. We've been through and continue to go through concerns about distrust in medicine. Where does this all fit in with those issues, with those tensions?
You know, I think that certainly became very clear. I think it was the Me Too that also kind of drove the importance of bringing this information forward about these procedures. It is of my understanding, it came from the medical students themselves, where they were finding, you know, am I crossing my ethical boundaries by doing, you know, learning this procedure while the woman is unconscious and not knowing that I'm doing this. And I think that with that, we've been able to really bring this, you know, increase this awareness, and at the same time, you know, say let's put the stops on this, and let's make sure we have policies in place that inform the student, informs the instructor that we need the permission.
Do you have any sense that a number of hospitals and clinics are already doing this, have a consent form already for pelvic exams and a patient perhaps in surgery, coming out of surgery?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I've heard that that it's already being done, which and kudos to those, you know, organizations or institutions that have put the patient first. You know, there's, if I could, some caveats to this, and I don't mean
please
to change
go ahead.
The mm-hmm. Okay. So because the language says that you need written permission, and it looks as though even the provider, a provider, not teaching a student, but a provider, you know, needs written or verbal permission. And we had a question with our public policy council that, you know, we have SANE nurses, those are your sexual assault nurse examiners, who do perform pelvic exams. And sometimes that patient is unconscious because she's been sexually assaulted, physically assaulted, and incapable of giving permission for a pelvic exam. And we know the importance of getting that exam conducted as soon as possible to collect that, you know, that forensic evidence is necessary. And I'm not sure if this would impact the policy that says, no, you need permission. So we're going to be looking for some clarity surrounding that. We also think the other situation, you know, we have women that are in labor and have come in preeclamptic to the point where the toxins have rendered them unconscious. Again, it would be, you know, it needs to be a standard of care that you're doing that pelvic examination to see about the condition of that baby. So there are just some of those situations where we think maybe medically necessary or something like that should be in there so that not everyone that's in the best interest of that patient
to ensure the proper care is being delivered.
Yes. And we're not seeing that. And maybe it's already in existing statute somewhere. But
Gina, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Gina Denick-Champion is Chief Executive Officer of the Wisconsin Nurses Association. That's the organization lobbying on behalf of the state's 90,000 registered nurses. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.